We're at the last of our three contestant spotlight episodes, and this time we're looking at Bobby. With some additional coaching from Geek History Lessons' Ashley Robinson, can Bobby put together a finale-worthy podcast? Find out on this episode of America's Next Top Podcaster. Welcome to America's Next Top Podcaster. I'm your host, Brian Ibbett. We're in the last of our three contestant entry episodes, and this time we're following Bobby. As winner of our editing challenge, Bobby received a bonus coaching session with Ashley Robinson, star of the Red Shirt Diaries and co-host of Geek History Lesson. We'll listen in on their coaching session, as well as a session with Tom, and then we'll close out the show with his finished interview podcast. But first, I got to sit down with him to talk about the challenge. I'm here with Bobby Frankenberger. Bobby, how is it going?
It's going pretty well, Brian. I just had breakfast for dinner, so I don't know how you can top that.
Oh, I love breakfast for dinner. It's funny because it's such an easy thing to do, like cook eggs, cook bacon, toast, hash browns, whatever.
Yeah.
And usually dinners are a lot more involved. I don't know why we don't have breakfast for dinner all the time.
I don't know. Someone decided one day that you know, waffles were a breakfast food and you couldn't have any other meal. And it's people like you and me, Brian, that need to keep rebelling against that and fighting.
I agree. 100%. All right, let's talk interview week. We're exactly a week into, I call it interview week. It's interview 3 weeks. Right. you guys have a lot more time, which I think you'd even remarked how, what a change of pace. It's almost disconcerting, right? Like going from this bam, 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 week after week after week thing. And now it's like you're in an ocean where you were in a puddle before.
It's like, do you know what velocitation is?
No, I don't.
It's the feel. I don't know if this is a real word or not, or if someone told me one time 10 years ago, made up a word and then it stuck with me. But it's that feeling you get when you've been driving on the interstate for a long time and then you get off. And you're driving on regular road and everything feels weird. Like either you feel like you're going really fast or too slow and just everything's off. That's the feeling I have right now.
Oh, that totally makes sense. You know, back when rollerblading was a thing, I'd get that if I was rollerblading for an extended period of time, took them off and then started walking around. I felt like I was like I should be gliding, like there was something holding my feet back. Yeah. So right. I know exactly what you mean. With that in mind, where are things at? Have you scheduled your interview? Have you conducted your interview?
My interview's scheduled. I'm having my interview in just a few days. Okay. I actually got it pretty fast. I did exactly what Justin suggested last week, which is right after we got off of our recording the judging and elimination episode, and then all the next morning, I just sent tons of emails and I shot for like really high and everything in between. Maybe in the judging episode or something, I'll say some of the people I sent emails to. I don't want people to be disappointed when they hear the episode. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Yes, exactly. Like,
but I did get somebody pretty exciting. Should I say who it is or should I wait?
You can definitely say who it is because this will air in the episode with your interview. So,
right. So it's a lot of people might not have heard the name. His name is Banachek. That's his stage name. Right. He's a magician. And he's a magician and mentalist. And he is the head of the James Randi Educational Foundation, which is a skeptical organization that issues and gives grants to organizations that are furthering the goals of critical thinking and public awareness of critical thinking, and also like consumer protection in frauds and scams and stuff like that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, but he's a big, huge name in the skeptical community, which I'm a big part of. So it was really exciting to get an interview with him.
it sounds like he's kind of the Penn and Teller of mentalism, right? Because he's
yes.
he's not one of those people who's saying, oh no, mentalism is a real thing. I'm totally doing it.
Right.
He's basically doing it to prove that it can't be done or that it's not real kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. So, and a lot of magicians are actually like that. There's, as you might imagine, magicians are very aware of the ways that you can fraud and scam people, because that's kind of what they're doing for a living, right
yeah.
And there's definitely a spectrum of them about how honest they are about it and how dishonest they are about it. And so yeah, Penn and Teller and also Banachek, they're definitely way on the quite honest about it end of that spectrum. They're skeptical activists and stuff like that. So
cool. I love it when I just love it when magicians are on our side. It feels like they've got power they can use for good and they can use for evil, and this is Banachek definitely uses it for good. That's great. So your interview, obviously you're going to be talking about with your skepticism background, that's obviously going to be a big focus of your interview,
right?
Are you going to have him, I guess, how do you do mentalism over a podcast? Is there a way to do that?
So
what number am I thinking of?
Right. And maybe I will get him to try a trick or something, or maybe explain how one goes, but there's a very specific angle I'm going in, and I'll give the quick elevator pitch because I don't want to spoil story. But as you could probably guess with the way I've conducted interviews and just all my approach to all the stuff we've done so far is I went into every potential interview and idea with, what's the story going to be? I want to tell a story. That's what I like to do. And Banachek, when he was back in the 70s, he was involved in I guess you would call it a hoax, with James Randi, who was some people might know who are listening to this. James Randi has been involved in he's a magician also, and he's also been involved in a lot of like uncovering hoaxes and scammers and paranormal scams and stuff like that. Anyway, Banachek was part of something that was organized by James Randi called the Project Alpha, which was to basically, they said parapsychological research, which is the psychology of like psychic phenomena and telekinesis and stuff like that. Scientific research involving that is just really lax and not very good. So we want to point out those flaws by taking two magicians and sending them undercover as subjects in this research and have them claim to be psychics see if they can convince the researchers that they're actually psychic. Because that would, if they are faking it and doing it that way, that would point out the flaws in their research methodology.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so it's a very interesting and exciting story that has some twists and turns towards the end of it and stuff like that. It took place over several years, but that's what the story is going to be about. And that's what I'm really excited to talk to him about.
That's great. And that is a really good piece of advice when you're going into an interview, not just have your list of questions, but figure out what it is, what the story is. And nine times out of 10 with an interview, it's going to be who is the person that I'm talking to is going to be the story, right? What's their background or what's their interest. But this sounds like it's even a bigger, actually a more finite or fine pointed story you're telling, which I love. I love the fact that, all right, we're going to be learning who Banachek is, but beyond that, we're going to be learning about this James Randi an alpha study thing. That sounds absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. And that's the biggest thing, that one of the big things I've learned about interviewing in this competition. I kind of knew it academically going in, but never had put it into practice, which is that anytime you go into an interview, it really benefits you. Even if it's, it really benefits you to know ahead of time what the story is you want to tell, even if it's going to be a style interview like David Letterman's Netflix show that he has, where he sits down and talks to people. And he's a brilliant master artist when it comes to interviews, right?
Yeah.
But you can tell when you watch, especially if you're like thinking about these things and you watch it, you can tell he has a story in mind that he wants to tell with that person. And you can see it all the time because he in his funny way, just like cuts off side rails and stuff that are taken all the time. But that's my big advice to anybody who wants to, that I've learned through this competition, is that you got to know ahead of time, what story are you trying to tell?
That's great. And I think I'm going to definitely have to do that next time I watch one of the David Letterman interviews, is watch for that, because I hadn't noticed that before, but...
Yeah, he does it for sure. Yeah.
That's great. Excellent. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing it. Good luck. Are you excited about the editing portion of this? I mean, you've done really well with the editing in the past, so that should be a no-brainer, right?
It's a lot of work.
Yeah,
it's always,
I guess, not a no-brainer, but at least that's not an aspect of it that you're that you're dreading.
Yeah, I feel like I know how to do that pretty well. I've done it, and I'm not dreading that. That's a good way to put it. I'm not dreading that. but it's definitely a lot of work. But I'm gonna have plenty of time, right?
You got plenty of time. Eating some turkey leftovers and editing a podcast.
yeah, exactly.
Fantastic. Well, Bobby, thank you so much, man. Great talking to you.
You too, Brian.
Let's see how things went when they met with the coach, Tom Merritt.
Congratulations, Bobby.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So for this week, since you're doing something you've done before, it's not like this is the first time we're doing an interview challenge. You've got a little more time to work on it already. I just wanted this session to be sort of open for you to chat with me, ask questions, get bad advice from me that will piss off the judges, whatever you want. We could just kind of whatever you want to talk about, whatever you want to ask, let's do it.
Okay, well, good, because I've already lined up the interview. I already know what I'm going to talk about, what story I'm trying to tell with the interview. So I think it'd be good to let you hear that and then tell me what you think and help me shape, like, what questions do I need to make sure I'm asking and to get what I need to tell this story. What about that?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, so I'm interviewing, he's a magician mentalist named Banachek. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
Yeah, it sounds familiar.
He's the head of he's the current head of the James Randi Educational Foundation.
That's why.
And James Randi stepped down because he's real old. But he's the head of that, and I'm talking to him specifically about something he did back when he was a teenager in the 70s with James Randi, which was Project Alpha. Mm-hmm. Project Alpha was basically the focus of the story I'm trying to tell. So I'll just say it in terms of that. It's basically two teenage magicians, one of which is Banachek. Two teenage magicians go undercover into a highly funded parapsychology research study, posing as psychics. Mm-hmm. They do so. They do such a good job fooling the scientists in the study that everyone believes they're real, and one researcher even tries to get them to do psychic healing on a sick family member. So that's where I am, and the point of the story, I want to kind of, the angle at the end of it when we come out of it, I want it to be focused on, you know, what are the bad things, like a critical thinking focus, right? Like, so the podcast itself that it'll sit inside would be like a sciencey, critical thinking focused, maybe skeptical podcast or something like that. But that's the angle, is like, we're telling this story because we want to talk about critical thinking and where it can fail.
Yeah. This is a good road. It's certainly a fascinating historical topic, especially if people haven't heard about this before, and sort of getting into like, how did you fool them? Why did you fool them? Why do you think these otherwise, you know, it's not like they're a bunch of dummies. These are pretty smart people. And then I think your instinct is absolutely right to tie it into something current. I think you need something a little more solid than just tying it into critical thinking focus. My instinct, this may or may not be the way you want to go, but just as an example, if nothing else, tying it into fake news and saying like, how are the ways you fooled these professors similar to the way people are being fooled or misled in the current social media platform situation?
Yeah, that's a really good point to bring it to, I guess, at the end of the discussion, what lessons can people today, like right now, learn from what did you learn during all this, you know?
That yeah. Be, and I would make that a meaty part of the end, rather than just like a summing up question. My instinct would be to point to it maybe obliquely all the way through the interview of like trying to build up the points are like, things haven't changed. It's not like humans suddenly, you know, like, well, that was back then. Nobody can be fooled now. Like we have so many examples. So it doesn't have to be fake news. That's why I'm like, I don't know if this is the right example, but bringing it to the front so that when people listen to it, it's not just, oh, what an interesting historical thing that happened. It's, oh, this, he uncovered principles about us that are not only relevant, but super important to be aware of today.
So that's sort of like the, like this is an interesting story. I've described a story and that what you're describing now is, and this is why this is why you need to listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not just critical thinking focus, but why you even need critical thinking focus. And I think Banachek would be a great resource to get perspective on that because it's what the James Randi Foundation does, right?
Yeah, that's a good, and that kind of takes me a little bit in a, not in a different direction, but in a kind of like I was thinking that this whole thing would just be focused on telling the story. But I think you're right. At the very least, only the at the most, the first half should be telling the story, because once the story's told, I think you're right. The more interesting thing to modern. Like it's the whole story is interesting to me because I'm sort of like I'm in the skeptic community. So the whole mythology of the story is really interesting, but not everybody is.
Well, you could talk to him for 15 minutes about the history, then talk to him for 15 minutes about modern stuff. And then once you're done, sit down and figure out, okay, how much, maybe you get such a compelling interview with him about the modern, that the historical stuff that you decide, you know what, this is just great. It would be watering it down to try to put the modern stuff. Kind of depends on what you get, but I would go into it with the idea of, probably, like you say, at least 50% being the story, but then being able to draw out something above it could elevate it. That's my instinct anyway, is that you'll be able to pull something a little more than what people expect out of it. And if you can pull that off, that's the kind of thing that's going to wow the judges.
I think you're right about that. Something that I've always been thought about with almost all of the stuff we've done in the competition so far is, and my other teammates would laugh if they heard me say this, because I say this over and over again. I always said, how are we going to end this with a Jerry Springer moment? You know, and what my point always was like, why do people care? And what is the lesson we're going to give them to take home?
Right.
And I think you're right. I was kind of forgetting about that. Now that I'm on my own, it's like, I was forgetting about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why you always need beta readers and people to listen to stuff back and stuff, you know, to get that outside perspective for sure. You're going to reveal that you're Banachek's father at the end of this. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yes. Don't tell anybody. Spoilers.
Spoiler. That's definitely a Jerry Springer move.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's good. Here's a good angle to take the rest of the couple minutes that we have. As someone who has not done all the research and is just hearing this idea for the first time, what are the questions that you have? Like as a prospective listener, what are the things that you're like thinking right now? I wonder about this that I should make sure that I try to.
Yeah. You probably want to do a little bit of an introduction about what was happening at the time, who James Randi was, what the parapsychology scene was. You're going to have to bring up Uri Geller, cause you're not going to assume that everybody knows all of that stuff.
Right.
And then ask Banachek, okay, why did you do this? How did you prepare for it? And what were you expecting? Those are the things I want to know. Like, what were you thinking was going to happen? And what surprised you in the course of this? And why do you think it was that you were able to fool these, again, super smart people? Because it's tempting to be like, it's a bunch of dummies. And then look what Banachek did. He fooled those dummies. And the fact is, it's not about that. It's about humans forgetting to look past their own biases. And it can happen to any of us.
I'm glad you said that, because it reminds me that that's what is interesting to me about all this kind of thing is is there's an empathy to it, I think, and I want to get that across.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
This is not a point and laugh at those guys' story. This is a story about a lesson about how any of us can be these researchers.
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale, is what it is.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I want to know. I want to know all the place settings and what the aims were going in, and all that. That's where I would come from.
Okay, that's good. It's a lot. I got to figure out a good way to get that all into a short time, because there's so much to it, right?
But yeah. Well, and again, the nice thing is you can edit down. So you can even rephrase questions a couple of ways if you feel like, oh, that's not exactly, or that was too long. Yeah, and I think he's done enough of these at this point. You could even say like, can you say that for me, but shorter? Like,
yeah, right.
Totally
right.
Fair.
Yeah, I'm sure. That feels really good. I think my big challenge is going to be, I only have 30 minutes with him because he's a busy guy. I'm trying to do lots of prep to make sure I have all the questions that I need to ask, and where I need to go and stuff like that. So, but I feel good.
Yeah, this is a great topic, and this is a fascinating story. So that's the easy pitch. Like you said, your only challenge is to figure out how to make it more than people expect. You want to pull off that magic trick at the end.
Yeah. Right. I see what you did there.
The reason that's funny is.
Hello, Ashley.
Hi, Bobby.
How are you?
I'm so good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Like Brian said, I think I heard you drop an F-bomb over and over and over again, repeatedly as I edited your audio. So
fun fact, that's how I talk.
Great. I know you.
Yeah, on our show, we try very hard to keep it, family friendly. And right. That's very difficult for me. So thanks for making me seem like I have my stuff together.
Anything I can do. As you know, we have to book an interview and conduct an interview of anything of our choosing. I've already booked mine.
Okay.
So that part is done. That part of the process is over. I sent about 100 emails and got one of the ones that I was really excited about getting. Are you familiar with, the James Randi Educational Foundation or James Randi in general?
I am not. Should I be?
No, not necessarily. I was just wondering if you were, but the angle that I'm going to be going is I'm going to be interviewing a magician that is associated with the James Randi Educational Foundation.
And very cool.
And a cool project that he was involved with trying to expose, back in the 70s, to expose some faults in paranormal experimental testing and stuff like that. Whoa. So anyway, so I'm going to be preparing for the interview, and the biggest hurdle I have, because we've done several interviews, but the biggest problem I have with interviews is being comfortable talking to people that maybe are I perceive to be more important than me. I have a real social anxiety, and I'm trying to turn my phone off like a professional podcaster. I have a real social anxiety, and I have trouble dealing with. Is that something that you struggle with, or is that something that you have to overcome ever? Or
absolutely. So I'm going to be that real LA person and drop a name here. A few years ago, I had an opportunity to interview Ben Affleck when he was playing the Batman, and he is a notoriously not the warmest interview subject, and. Also is very tall. When he walked past me, he was Batman size, and it was a little intimidating.
Oh, wow.
But the great thing about when you're interviewing someone is I find as the host, you actually have more power because you're directing the conversation, and whoever you're speaking with is trusting that you are, or hopefully smart enough to trust that you are on their side, because right. There's no point to you asking to interview someone that you're not interested in or someone you'd like to connect with, or maybe someone they're being paid to talk to. So I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind, is that you're the person in charge, and they wouldn't have agreed to speak with you if they didn't trust what you were doing. And you know, in terms of someone more important than you, no one's more important than anyone. You know, we're all people on this earth just trying to do our best. And I always find that it goes off easier when you just ask them questions like they were your friend, because for those, you know, 10 or 15 or hour long segments of time, they are your allies and you're in it together. And then if that doesn't work, just pretend that they're your assistant. And if you had an assistant, you would want to be really kind to them because they could spit in your food. You know what I mean?
Right.
Actually, the first time I met Brian Ibbett, I was really, really nervous. And we were listening to a CD collection that he had curated as we pulled up to pick him up. And Jason Inman, who people also heard on my interview, said, "Oh, we have to turn this off. We can't let him know." And so then the first thing I told Brian was, "Oh, we were just listening to your Star Trek mix." People like to know that you're interested in them. It's very flattering, you know, and we all have egos.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I hadn't really thought about the fact that they wouldn't have agreed to talk to me if they weren't. I mean, it seems so simple, right? But even I had a probably like 25 email back and forth with this person's assistant anyway. So they obviously are finding out what you're doing, and there's been a lot of already communication there. So obviously they have gone into this eyes open and are trusting me, just like you said. So that's a really good point.
Yeah. And hopefully they've done, you know, a cursory Google search, but sometimes people surprise you.
Right. I'm aiming to tell a particular story with this interview. And so I guess I'm going to be looking to get that story told. Do you have any thoughts on how to make sure that I've only got 30 minutes with this guy?
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that I get all the pieces, like, but I want it told in sort of a, I don't know. Do you have any just general tips for how to ask questions that get like open, authentic responses rather than like stiff responses? Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, that can be a little tough, right? Because it really depends on who your subject is, and that's going to become pretty evident right away. I interview a lot of comic book artists, and while I love them dearly, some of my best friends are comic book artists. They're not often the biggest talkers.
Sure.
And so I find that kind of like we were discussing your level of comfort, you have to make sure that you are ensuring their level of comfort as well. A really basic thing, right, is have notes and, you know, have a game plan. I know that doing this process, you obviously already know how to do that because this isn't your first rodeo. But I find that I like to write down all the questions I want to ask and then highlight the ones that I absolutely have to ask, because especially if there's a time limit on it, whether that is self-imposed or imposed by your interviewee, if there is one thing that you really need to wrap up the narrative that you're trying to tell, then you really want to make sure that you get to that. And I think you could also just tell them honestly before you start recording, like, "Hey, I'm really looking for you to talk as much as possible. This is a storytelling exercise," so that they kind of know what you're looking for, because the more transparent and the more you can go into the process with everyone's eyes wide open, I find really helpful.
That's a good point. Not trying to sort of like muscle them into answering in the way that I want them to, but just telling them how I want them to answer.
Yeah, and I mean, this might be their first podcast, which sometimes really shocks you. You're like, "Really? This is the first time?" Or they might be used to like a more traditional, like a print interview where you can be brief but still get the point across. Like in an audio medium, you want as much audio content as possible.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So definitely I've been preparing, like you said, so I feel good there. I've got lots of questions that way, but if I want to, maybe I'm thinking like trying to just be, what am I trying to say? Trying to be vulnerable might help. Like,
I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but like the thing that concerns me the most is the mood and the tone and how I'm going to be feeling. And I think maybe if I start that way, it might make me and them comfortable at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know we like to throw the word vulnerable around, and that can be a really scary word because who wants to be vulnerable, even though that's when our most beautiful human moments come from.
Sure, yeah.
I think maybe an easier and less scary word, right, is authentic. Like you want to come across like you're a cool and interesting person who is talking to a cool and interesting person, and that's why you have invested in them and you want them to be on your show and all of these things that you already know going in. And I think you nailed it. I think you already know that answer. If you go in with a certain level of comfort, then that will really help open up the conversation. There's a technique called box breathing. That's really easy, right? You breathe in for four, you hold for four, you breathe out for four, you hold for four. It opens up your blood vessels and brings more oxygen to your brain. And it's what a lot of athletes or people who are professional competitors do before they go into whatever it is that they're doing. And I always find it really, really calming. It brings me back into my body. So if I'm nervous about anything, I like to box breathe for maybe 3 or 5 minutes before I start.
Oh my gosh. I don't know why somebody didn't give me a tip like that on. I'm really going to try that because that's...
I hope it helps.
No, because I get inside my own head so often when I'm like doing anything, really, and especially talking to people for an interview. So I'm definitely going to try that.
If it doesn't work, I'm sorry.
If I just hyperventilate and pass out, then...
then I don't claim any responsibility. I'll throw you right under that bus.
Right. Wow. This is I don't know. I feel like I've just had a therapy session with you this whole time.
That's so kind. Thank you.
Well, because I think that like you said, we've been doing this for so many weeks that the prep work and the types of questions to ask, I feel good about that. It's just I still haven't gotten over that hurdle of mentally being ready for and calm and comfortable yet. And I've always had someone else with me. This is the first time I'm going to be doing it by myself.
Dun, dun, dun. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So having that other person usually ends up helping, but I think this is going to help me a lot.
And also just remind yourself that you're nervous because you care. So you always want to be a little bit nervous.
Yeah.
I had a very good friend. She had a son who died of cancer. Of course, she had this huge gaping hole, you know, and there is no right thing to say to a woman like that. But she also had two little girls and she had a husband. She found a medium. She went to the medium. The medium convinced her that she could talk to her dead son. She stopped talking to her daughters. She stopped talking to her husband because she was trying to fill up this hole, right? Rather than turning to them and going through this process together, she was taking care of that hole in a whole different way with a scum medium, convincing her she could talk to her. So she almost ended up in a divorce. She almost ended up losing her children. Luckily, she came to her senses and that didn't happen. But I can't imagine how many people that does happen to.
Welcome to What's the Harm, where we hear stories from people that explore the very real but often overlooked harm that can be done by pseudoscience. I'm your host, Bobby Frankenberger. On this show, we don't spend a lot of time talking about claims of the paranormal, like spirit communication or psychics. We spend much more time talking about alternative medicine claims, things like acupuncture or homeopathy. And the reason is that it's easier to see the harm when false medical claims are being made, and it's much harder to point out the danger in trusting psychic phenomena. But the fact is that there are people out there ready to take advantage of us by convincing us they have paranormal powers, like psychic healing or bending objects with their minds. Fortunately, though, there are others who aren't willing to stand by while it happens, like the man you heard telling the story at the top of our show.
My name is Banachek.
Banachek, as you might have guessed, is not a psychic. In fact, he's a magician, or more specifically, a mentalist.
That's a person who takes his five known senses to create the illusion of a sixth sense. In other words, I'm a stage magician, but my tool is the mind and information.
And he's got a pretty impressive resume.
I create a lot of magic for different people. Chris Angel, most of his TV shows, I help create most of the magic for the Mind Freak series and a few other shows that he had. Penn and Teller, the bullet catch they perform on stage, I created the method for that.
He's appeared on the Today Show, CNN. He's written a number of books on mentalism. However, we wanted to talk to Banachek about his battle
against false claims of the paranormal and pseudoscience, and about how he's been fighting that battle for almost all his life.
A lot of people say, well, they make people feel good. So the grieving process is a part of life. When somebody passes away, in order for you to continue with the living, you have to go through this grieving process. They halt that. They stop that for personal gain or supposedly to make people feel good in that particular moment.
He's also got some serious credibility in the skeptic community.
I am the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation for the $1 million challenge, which means I have $1 million for any psychic that could actually show me a psychic phenomena that's real under proper scientific conditions.
Put simply, he wants self-proclaimed psychics to put up or shut up.
Nobody's taken the money yet.
And while this sounds like he's placing the blame at the feet of all the paranormal peddlers out there, he really isn't. A lot of the blame comes from bad science. People have been studying psychic phenomena for decades, legitimate scientists doing real studies, publishing in real scientific journals, and a lot of these papers claim to show real psychic effects. But Banachek and the majority of the scientific community say that this so-called science is bad.
Rather than using proper science to find out if psychic phenomena was real, they would be basically documenting what they already believed because they wanted to convince the rest of the world. So they would be videotaping it and showing those videos to the rest of the world, or, you know, using, you know, anecdotal evidence rather than using proper science.
The experimental protocol was lax and full of holes, and so the resulting data that they were calling evidence couldn't be trusted. And the reason this is problematic is because the psychics and mediums who are trying to defend themselves were pointing to this low-quality, untrustworthy data to back up their claims. So back in the late 70s, Banachek got so frustrated by the lazy science that was being done in support of psychic phenomenon that he decided something needed to be done. There was a new lab being funded with $500,000 at Washington University in St. Louis. The lab was being set up to explore the existence of paranormal abilities like metal bending and extrasensory perception, or ESP. Banachek wanted to expose the flaws and inherent bias of that research.
One thing I did know, that often when I was around intelligent people, super intelligent people, they were intelligent really in one area or within their environment. But you get them outside of their environment and they're not so smart. So I believe that because many of these professors who were studying psychic phenomena and already believed in it, I believe that they thought they were too smart to be fooled.
So he got together with celebrity skeptic James Randi and came up with a plan to go undercover as a psychic, to show the world how easy it would be to fool these researchers into believing that he was a psychic, and therefore revealing the flaws in this field of research. James Randi was this superstar psychic debunker at the time. He was a skeptic celebrity.
He was a magician.
Yes, and as a stage magician, he made a living fooling people and knew very well all the tricks used to make people think you had special powers. And all through the 1970s, Randi had been at war with this famous guy who was claiming to truly have psychic abilities, Uri Geller.
Now, Uri had convinced the world at that time that he could actually bend metal with his mind. He was the first one to tell people that that was possible. All the adults that I did know believed that Geller was real. You know, who wouldn't want to believe that you had some sort of superhuman power, something outside the boundaries of what your existence is in that particular moment?
James Randi spent a good part of the 70s going on TV, radio, even on Johnny Carson's The Tonight Show, talking about how Uri Geller was a fake.
The truth, as Randi said, was that Geller was nothing more than a magician using tricks, that it wasn't real.
So together with James Randi, they put the plan into motion. They called their undercover operation Project Alpha. Banachek would meet up with another teenager in St. Louis by the name of Mike Edwards.
Mike was the one who came up with the name Project Alpha.
And they worked hard over the next 4 years of working with these scientists to take advantage of every single flaw they could find in the experimental protocol. And it wasn't hard. It started from the very beginning. On the first day that they arrived there, Banachek and Edwards were left alone in a car with a briefcase.
And I happened to look in the back seat and I noticed that there's a briefcase back there. So I kind of like under the dash, bring it up to the front. So I open the case and inside there's all this cutlery, forks, spoons, knives. And I thought, well, either this guy's a kleptomaniac or this is some of the test material that he's going to have his work on in the laboratory. So I start bending it all up and I lock the case. I put it in the back.
And this worked to convince them from the very beginning that something psychic was going on.
Part of the reason we did this, part of it was because there's a thing called spontaneous PK that Yuri Geller would talk about.
Spontaneous PK, or psychokinesis, basically said that psychic energy could sometimes be so powerful that it would just spontaneously start bending metal around you.
Where things would just happen around him and he had no control.
When the scientists at the lab found that briefcase full of bent spoons and forks, they were hooked.
Because they've seen it with their own eyes. They just want the rest of the world to see it.
Another way they tricked the scientist while actually in the lab was to simply switch tags on pieces of silverware. Let me give a little background on this. James Randi at some point had warned the scientists about 11 caveats that they should follow in order to have very strict experimental protocol and avoid being tricked by any fake psychics. However, the scientists ignored all 11 of them. One of these caveats was to be sure to mark each test item on the macro and the micro level.
They didn't mark everything on a micro and macro level. They primarily marked it on a macro level. And what they did was they had these little string tags that were numbered on each piece of cutlery. And then they would measure, say, a spoon right at the center of the bowl, at the end on one side and at the end on the other side, how many millimeters it is from the height of the table, right? So that if it bends at all, you'll be able to go down your list and say number 11 should be these numbers. Oh, wait a minute. It's bent 2 or 3 millimeters, right? So I'm holding it and I'm looking at it and I go, you know, this tag's getting in my way as I'm stroking the spoon. Can I remove it? And they're like, yes. So now I've broken the first one of the rules, right? One of the rules is don't let me control the experiment. I'm now controlling the experiment. I concentrate on it. Nothing happens. I put it back on the table. I pick up a fork. I concentrate and say, do you mind if I remove the tag off this one? They go, no problem. I put it down on the table next to the other tag. I concentrate on the fork. Nothing really happens. I pick up the tags and I put them back on the spoon and the fork. The only difference is I switch the tags, right? So that now, when they measure them later on, maybe 2 hours later, when I pick it up and I concentrate on it and I say, can you try to, you know, can you measure this one and see if anything happened? It's bent 3 or 4 millimeters because the position has actually changed, right?
They were also warned not to leave multiple test items out on the table at the same time, as they would be too hard to keep track of and could be manipulated.
And the other thing was sometimes there'd be multiple spoons and forks on the table. And as you reached across to get another one, you simply put your elbow on one of the spoons, pressed down slightly and picked up one of the other ones, and then you come back to that other one that you bent much, much later.
So these are just some of the ways that the protocol was so lax. Another way that they were able to trick the scientists was so incredibly simple.
They would have these envelopes, and inside every single envelope was a picture. And then they would show us a slide, and we would concentrate on the envelopes and decide which envelope it was in. Was it a number 3, number 7, or number 8? But they would leave us alone in the room to do those type of experiments. I figured out, since I was sitting in the room alone, that I could actually take a staple, open it up, because it was they were stapled shut, the envelopes. And I took them and I put them in a little ashtray. I would just take the picture, look, see what it was, close it up, push the staples back through. And then I would walk out later on and I would say, I think it's number 17. And of course, it would be number 17. And we always did it to the point to where we kept it like above odds, but not like correct every single time, because that would be suspicious.
Toward the end of the run of Project Alpha, and remember, this went on for 4 years, things started to get really uncomfortable for them. There was one scientist, Berthold Schwartz, who was not part of the lab where they were being studied, but he was very interested in what they were doing.
So Berthold Schwartz, I didn't know this at the time. I had absolutely no clue. His daughter was a diabetic, and she actually had to wear an insulin pack. I met her right towards the very end of Project Alpha, like after I'd already been in Schwartz's place 2 or 3 times. He had mentioned once or twice when I was there that if this type of phenomena is real, who knows what we can do with it? We might be able to do all kinds of things. We might be able to find ways to influence things on a molecular level to where we might be able to cure diseases. I didn't put 2 and 2 together at that time, although there was one point where he did ask me in a phone call. He had a friend on the phone. He says, hey, could you maybe concentrate and try and make him feel better? I said, no, I can't do that. He said, well, just talk to him. That might make him feel better. But in my mind as a kid, I never put 2 and 2 together that he was thinking that I might be able to heal his daughter, or maybe this had healing abilities.
They had convinced the scientists so completely that people were even coming from out of the country to see them.
There was a point where a producer came over from England, and he said to the Amazing Rand, he said, look, what would convince you this was real? And he gave him the same 11 caveats that he had given the scientists. This producer followed every single one. He took a whole day, and he was working with me, Mike Edwards, and a kid by the name of Masawaki Kyoto from Japan. Well, nothing happened because he followed Randy's rules. The moment the cameras went off, Masawaki twisted a spoon or made it appear like he was twisting it with his mind. The producer had a complete mental breakdown,
Started because he didn't get to catch it on camera?
Didn't catch it on camera. I shouldn't have listened to Randy. I would have had this to show it to the world if I hadn't listened to Randy. Randy's evil. Randy's a devil. And then he looks down at his pants, and excuse me for saying this, but this is exactly the way it went down. There was a wet spot on his pants, and he started saying he had a demonic ejaculation.
Oh my gosh. This
is the breakdown that he had. And this scared the hell out of me and Mike, because at that point, we're thinking, oh, it's just magic tricks, right? We didn't realize how powerful this type of stuff was for certain people. And we went to Randy right there. We said, look, we need to come clean on this, and we need to do it soon.
And so they finally did. They came clean and ended Project Alpha.
When we came out and explained that everything that we had done during those 4 years was an illusion, the scientists wouldn't answer their phone, except for us. They were waiting for us to call them. He says, well, it can't be true. We've seen you do impossible things. And I go, unfortunately, it is. And it was really heart-wrenching for me to do that because they were good people. I don't like hurting people. And I didn't realize that side of the consequences of things, that I was going to be hurting these individuals. And, you know, I was a kid. I also didn't understand that their reputations might be ruined for a while.
But in the end, Banachek says that he believes it was worth it.
At the time, I think there were a lot of changes made in the way that parapsychology was studied. A lot of funding was taken away. More serious people, you had to use proper science at that point because people were scrutinizing you if you're going to stay in those type of studies. So I think that was a good thing. And a lot of people say that Uri Geller didn't really do any bad, but I think he harmed science, right? There's a lot of money being wasted on pseudoscience when it could actually be going into greater things and much, you know, discoveries that will actually change the world.
Now, it's really easy to look at this and just point at those dummies who got fooled. But when I hear this story, I see it much more as a cautionary tale. These were smart people, scientists, but they were fooled. It makes me think a lot about social media, really. It doesn't feel so different from this. Like, I feel like the scientist in that lab all the time. I think I know how to tell when I'm being scammed. I think I know how to tell the difference between real news and fake news. But do I?
If you go in blindly, somebody is going to con you. Somebody is going to take advantage of you. There are wolves in sheep's clothing out there willing to take your money willingly, and they will convince you to give it to them. Like, just hand it over to them, because they're going to go with your core beliefs. They're going to go with your own biases, and they're going to use your own biases against you. And you need to be aware of that.
Thank you very much to the James Randi Educational Foundation and, of course, Banachek for talking to me about Project Alpha. It was very fascinating. I learned a lot. And thank you to everyone for listening. Please join us next week as we once again answer the question, what's the harm?
That was What's the Harm? The solo interview challenge entry from Bobby. Our next episode is the judging and elimination episode, where two players will make it to our finals, while our third one will finish with a very respectable third place. It's all coming up this week on America's Next Top Podcaster.